I'd like to introduce Dr. Peter D'Onofrio. He graduated from the University of Dayton with a bachelor's and a master's degree in business administration before earning a PhD in American history, Civil War from LaSalle University in 1998. He's been active in many historical reenactments and has both published and presented several articles. Prior to his scholarly pursuits, he learned about traumatic injuries firsthand as a professional paramedic and has taught in various training facilities, including the National Fire Academy in Maryland. Please welcome Dr. D'Onofrio.
Well, thank you. Can everybody hear me all right?
Speak up.
Speak up? Okay. How about now?
That's good.
Hope there's something besides water in there. I may need it. Okay. I would like to thank Leanne and Cassie and the various groups that are sponsoring this evening for having me up here. Although, and I hate to admit this, although I have been in Ohio since 1969, the first time I've ever been to Youngstown. The only thing I really know about Youngstown is that there's an awful lot of D'Onofrios in Youngstown. None of them are my relatives. But since I know how to get here now, I will definitely make a point to come back and visit at various times. So, this evening, what we're going to present is some of the advancements that came about as a result of the tragedy that occurred in this country 150 years ago. As you may or may not know, the Civil War was the first modern war that resulted in the highest number of U.S. casualties per capita of any of our wars, as somewhere in the neighborhood of 625,000 men were killed, another 475,000 were wounded. In addition to that, 50,000 civilians were killed. Now, those figures are ones that we know about, that the Army medical departments back then were able to record. There's several medical historians that are suggesting that that number is probably closer to 1 million to 1.5 million because of the soldiers that were discharged because of their illness or their wounds that ended up dying later on after they had gotten back home. But the official records, 625,000 killed. Now, this death toll exceeded the total number of soldiers that were killed in the American Revolution, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, the Korean War, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and over half that were killed in Vietnam. So as you can tell, the American Civil War affected either directly or indirectly nearly every family, both in the North and the South. And while looking at these numbers, the impact on the U.S. population is probably rather obvious. What is not so obvious, even today, was the rapid advances that were made by American medicine that were stimulated by this conflict. Hopefully, by the time you leave here this evening, after seeing this presentation, you'll understand what those advances were, and you'll understand their impact on the subsequent development of American medicine. Now, the first major battle, new computer, I'm not used to it. The first major battle was fought at Bull Run, or Manassas, depending on which side of the line you favor, in July of 1861. Now, the battlefield was 27 miles from the capital, Washington City, as it was known back then. The battle had been announced in advance, and many of the Society of Washington, many members of Congress, packed picnic baskets, got into their carriages, and drove to the battlefield, expecting some entertainment in the form of the Union Army defeating the Confederate Army. Well, in the beginning, the Union Army under General Irwin McDowell seemed to be winning the day. They were pushing back the Confederate Army under General Beauregard. But at a critical moment in the battle, Confederate General Joe Johnson, his 9,000-man army, came in from the Shenandoah Valley and just pitched right into the Union lines, ending up with the Union Army panicking and running from the field. The Union lost over 600 killed, a little over 1,000 wounded, and over 1,400 missing. Medical care was non-existent at this time, at this battle. There was no organized evacuation of the wounded, and no hospitals were available to handle the magnitude of the casualties that resulted from this battle. Those who wounded who did manage to make their own way back 27 miles to Washington City filled the streets seeking shelter and treatment. Now, by 1864, Lincoln found his general, Ulysses S. Grant, an Ohio native, and the war entered a new phase. All the previous generals in the Union, for the most part, figured that in order to win the war, we need to occupy land. We need to get the capital of the Confederacy. Well, that didn't work out, obviously. Grant's philosophy was, we go after the army. So as a result, he locked Lee's Army of Northern Virginia in a death grip that did not allow Lee to maneuver. In the Battle of the Wilderness and in Spotsylvania Courthouse, both in Virginia, in the first couple of weeks of May, the Union Army suffered over 42,000 casualties. Lee was forced to fall back to Richmond, and Grant, pursuing him, wheeled around Richmond to the north and east. Now, on July 2nd and 3rd of 1864, the Battle of Cold Harbor was fought. Lee and the Confederate Army had time to entrench themselves, prepare defenses, and in the only frontal assault that Grant ever made while he was in command, he lost over 7,000 soldiers in the first 30 minutes of the battle. Okay. By that time, the U.S. Army Medical Department's organization was complete and was capable of handling these mass casualties that had occurred in the previous month to clear out their hospitals to handle these new 7,000 casualties. By the way, this was more than the U.S. Army Medical Department has ever encountered before or since from a single battle. Now, in the antebellum army, merit had absolutely nothing to do with promotion. It was based strictly on seniority. Because of this, the Surgeon General of the Medical Department in 1861 was Colonel Thomas Lawson, who was over 80 years old, had been around since the War of 1812, and was dying of cancer. He ran a very miserly office. He published books on the extravagance of medical care and the unnecessary expense of buying medical textbooks. At the start of the war, more than half of the medical officers of the Union Army resigned to join the Confederate Army. The result was that the Union Army started the war with only 98 medical officers, including the Surgeon General. Now, in the early part of the war, hygienic conditions for this vast volunteer army were virtually non-existent. Disease was rampant in the camps around Washington City. Because of the public outcry regarding the woeful treatment of the sick and the injured, a sanitary commission was formed. Now, this was organized by some very prominent citizens, including numerous prominent medical men, and initially their object was to sting the morbid-bound medical department into action. The commission asked the president for a new Surgeon General, and lobbied Congress and the President for a corps of medical inspectors to go around inspecting the camps and providing suggestions for the health and welfare of the soldiers. The commission stated at this point that it was not accusing the medical department of misfeasance or malfeasance, but of nonfeasance because it did nothing at all. As a result of their actions, a competent Surgeon General, William Alexander Hammond, was appointed on April 16th of 1862. Hammond had been in the regular army before the war, but had resigned his commission to accept a professorship at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Once the war started, he rejoined the army. Regrettably, he lost all his seniority, so he was on the bottom of the totem pole. He was promoted, much to the chagrin of many senior officers, over them. But he was a progressive man. He was a far-thinking man, an extremely well-educated and renowned doctor and surgeon. Hammond insisted that detailed medical reports be kept by all his officers. He initiated the Army Medical Museum, which is now over at Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and proposed a military medical school. He appointed an outstanding medical director for the Army of the Potomac, which was the major Union Army, and Dr. Jonathan Letterman. In a series of reforms that we're going to talk about this evening, Letterman developed a model for the U.S. Army Medical Department that became the model for all U.S. conflicts up to and including the present conflicts going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, at the time of the first Bull Run, the chief medical officer of the Army of the Potomac was responsible only to his general. His authority was limited to the very few regular Army medical officers that were assigned to his command. So as a result, he had no authority over the vast amount of volunteer physicians who had been appointed by the governors of their states and who reported to their regimental commanders. As a result, discipline was such that surgeons would only treat the wounded and the sick from their regiment and wouldn't help their fellow doctors. There was a report of one surgeon whose regiment was heavily engaged in battle. He was overwhelmed. The surgeon of the regiment right next to him, whose men had not been yet engaged, refused to come over and help the first surgeon because they weren't his men. They didn't belong to his regiment. Now, the competence of the medical officers, particularly the surgeons at the beginning of the war, was highly questionable. Now, let me clarify one thing. The term doctor, physician, and surgeon are used interchangeably, even though the vast majority of the doctors that were in the conflict, both North and South, had very little surgical experience. Some of them had never seen a gunshot wound before in their careers. While these volunteers were readily available to care for the wounded, most of these physicians that came to the battlefield wanted to do only one thing, and that was to operate. As a result, in the early part of the war, many needless procedures, such as amputations, were performed so that these doctors could perfect their techniques. However, all had one thing in common, and that was the lack of sanitation and hygiene. Following the Battle of Gettysburg in July of 1863, volunteer civilian surgeons were recruited, certified, and paid to supplement the medical officers of the Army. But during the course of the 4 years or so of the war, more than 5,000 surgeons were hired and used primarily to staff the general hospitals located in the major cities of the North. By the time of Grant's major campaigns in 1864, there were over 190 regimental surgeons, 42 contract surgeons, 175 nurses and medical students assigned to the Army of the Potomac alone. Each regiment had one surgeon and two assistant surgeons attached to it who were assigned to the field hospitals. And by 1864, operating surgeons were screened on the basis of performance, which included prudence, judgment, and skill. At the end of the war, over 13,000 physicians had served in the field and general hospitals of the North. Full surgeons in the Union Army held the rank of major and were paid $169 a month. Assistant surgeons were either captains or lieutenants, depending on their length of service, and received $155 and $105 respectively per month. Multiply those dollar amounts by 40, and you get an idea of what they would be paid in today's dollars and cents. Nurses. In the beginning, men from the ranks attended in the hospitals. They were those soldiers that had sufficiently recovered from their injury or from their illness and were able to provide that service, or who were detailed from their regiments by their commanders because they were malingerers, and the regimental commander was just as happy to get rid of them as to have them in the regiment taking up space. Well, needless to say, order, discipline, and hygiene was entirely lacking. Now, except during the early stages of the Crimean War, which had occurred just a few years prior to our conflict, there was no precedent for the use of female nurses, but competent help was desperately needed. Dorothea Dix, who had founded numerous insane asylums in this country, volunteered in April of 1861 to recruit and train nurses, and she was appointed superintendent of female nurses. In the beginning, Dix appointed all nurses, but later the Surgeon General was allowed to appoint nurses as well. Dix's screening limited appointments to non-attractive, mature women, thus ensuring a constant shortage of nursing staff. Ladies, none of you would have made Dorothea, or she was referred to, Dragon Dix's qualifications. You're all too good looking. Now these women, these civilian women, came full of idealism from civilian life and generally wished to function independently, much like nurses today. As a result, they were often in conflict with the orders of physicians, and in some cases justifiably so. In contrast, it was found that nuns worked especially well since they were trained in obedience and cooperated with the surgeons. They were first used in the West since Dorothea Dix, recruiting primarily in the East, objected to Catholics. A few of the orders that served during the war were the Sisters of Mercy, the Sisters of St. Joseph, and the Sisters of the Holy Cross. This represented the introduction of the Catholic orders in America to the hospital business. Now, as you can imagine, the feminine touch revolutionized the care of the sick and wounded. The women were strong morale builders, and as a rule, were far more empathetic and considerate of the wounded than their male counterparts. They cleaned up the hospitals. They made life miserable for those physicians they thought lax or incompetent. Nothing's changed in 150 years. Their efforts were confined primarily to large general hospitals. However, some few did serve in the field hospitals. Most notable among them were Mother Mary Ann Bickerdike, who tended to the wounded on such bloody battlefields as Shiloh. She attached herself to General Sherman's army, another Ohio boy. And Sherman said of her when a doctor complained about Mother Bickerdike, "I can do nothing, She outranks me. Approximately 4,000 women are thought to have served in the Union hospitals. Regrettably, figures are unavailable for Southern nurses, as just about 99% of the Surgeon General's records were burned when Richmond was evacuated at the end of the war. Clara Barton, another one of the Union nurses, went on after the war to found the American Red Cross. Now, at Bull Run and immediately thereafter, ambulances were totally unsatisfactory. Imagine being wounded, shot in the leg, maybe having a fracture as a result of that, riding in one of these contraptions over rough, rutted, muddy roads. Not a pleasant experience. Of the few that were available, most were poorly constructed two-wheel types, such as shown here, that readily broke down. Civilian drivers had been hired from the battle, but they, like all the spectators and the Army, panicked and fled the field without picking up any of the wounded. The Sanitary Commission, in a report, stated that there was no record of a single wounded soldier reaching Washington City by ambulance after the first Battle of Bull Run. At the second Battle of Bull Run, basically over the same field, in August of 1862, an even bigger scandal occurred. After the regular ambulance drivers defected, those who were hired to take their place picked the pockets of the wounded, stole the alcohol from the medical supplies, and ignored the complaints of the injured and dying. It was quite evident that there was a need for an ambulance corps. At the time, the ambulances were under the control of the Quartermaster Corps, and it was readily apparent that the priorities of supplying the troops in the field were in conflict with those of the wounded. Even some of the Army generals were unsympathetic to the needs of the sick and the wounded. Union General Don Carlos Buell in the Western Theater was one of the worst. He refused to have men assigned to evacuate the wounded or even provide the medical department the resources so that they could do it. As far as Buell was concerned, a soldier unfit for battle had no priority. By the time of Cold Harbor in 1864, the ambulance system had been reorganized. This was the result of the constant agitation and campaigning of Dr. Henry Bowditch of Boston. Dr. Bowditch was a member of the Sanitary Commission who had lost his son during the Peninsula Campaign of 1862. His son had been wounded and had laid on the field for days, dying of his wounds because of the unavailability of ambulances. Finally, in March 1864, Congress passed the ambulance bill. The Quartermaster Department still had control of the ambulances, but their use for any other purpose was strictly prohibited. Four-wheeled ambulances with professional drivers ready to evacuate the wounded from the aid station on the battlefield to the field hospitals by the time Grant started his campaigns in 1864. At Bull Run, those wounded who managed to get themselves back to Washington could not gain hospital admittance. The largest hospital there had only 40 beds. In the months immediately preceding Bull Run, additional hospitals were being improvised from hotels, from churches, and private homes. The big problem is there was no organized system for hospital admissions. The regimental surgeons would send wounded from their limited field hospital facilities to adjacent cities without knowing whether or not any hospital beds were even available. By the time of the 1864 Battle of Cold Harbor occurred, an efficient system of handling mass casualties had been developed. The system consisted of a field aid station located immediately behind the battle lines and field hospitals that were within a couple of miles of the battle and accessible by road. General hospitals located in or near the major northern cities, provided chronic care for those wounded who were transferred from the field hospitals. The availability of general hospitals permitted the rapid clearing of the field hospitals, leaving them ready for the next engagement. As I mentioned before, each regiment was served in an aid station by an assistant surgeon and or a steward. This forward station was located close to the proximity of the battle lines, usually 100 to 200 yards, and hopefully in some kind of protected or semi-protected position. At the beginning of the war, it was not unusual for a wounded man to be helped off the field by his comrade. A soldier with nothing more serious than a flesh wound might be evacuated by as many as four of his friends. This obviously was a problem that could very easily depopulate any attacking force once it had sustained a few wounded. By 1864, it was the practice of the regimental commander to assign 20 to 30 men, usually including the band, to serve as stretcher bearers and medical aides. All these men were unarmed and carried a canteen and a haversack with first aid supplies. They wore distinctive badges. The more seriously wounded were taken by stretcher to the aid stations. Treatment at the aid station consisted of basic first aid, bleeding control, bandaging wounds, some splinting, administration of opiates and whiskey for pain and shock. Horse-drawn four-wheeled ambulances were evacuating the wounded from the aid stations to the field hospitals by 1864. Jonathan Letterman, medical director of the Army of the Potomac in 1862, instituted the reorganization of the field system of care that by 1864 was extended to all Union armies. The inefficient regimental system was discarded in favor of brigade and finally division organization. By the time of Cold Harbor, divisional field hospitals were grouped together by corps to form large hospital complexes. These were located at a suitable point 1 to 2 miles from the probable battle location. In the divisional organization, the most accomplished medical officers were assigned to perform all the major operations. Some were assigned as surgical assistants or wound dressers, while others were assigned administrative responsibility. Once the wounded arrived at the hospital, they were lifted from the ambulance and placed on the operating table for complete evaluation. This consisted of probing the wounds with instruments or the surgeon's most readily available probe, his finger, to determine the nature of the injury. This was followed by the removal of any foreign objects, any loose bone fragments, and debridement. Now, the more humane surgeons use chloroform or ether before beginning this examination. Definitive treatment was carried out almost immediately, as it had been recognized and accepted that amputations and other operative treatment were best done within the first 24 hours of the patient suffering his wound. Subsequent to that, it was found that infection usually precluded and dramatically increased the risk with these procedures. Now, you must remember that this was before the time of asepsis and antisepsis and Lister's germ theory, and this decision no doubt played a major role in improving results. General hospitals. These were located in the major northern cities: Washington, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and referred to as such because they admitted men from any unit. In the early stages of the war, hospitals were considered spread as a disease and a major cause of mortality. People back then, the only time you went to a hospital is if you were indigent or you had no family that could take care of you. But in most cases, family would take care of you when you were sick or injured. Thus, at the start of the war, there was not a single general military hospital anywhere in the country. The largest post hospital, with only 41 beds, was located in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. In 1862, a vast building program began, and by 1863, the North had 151 hospitals with over 58,000 beds. And by the end of the war, there were 204 hospitals and close to 137,000 beds available. These hospitals ranged in size from 100 beds to Mower General Hospital, shown here in Philadelphia, which had a capacity of 4,000 beds. By the end of the conflict, hospitals were of the pavilion style and were well-ventilated buildings connected by corridors. During the Crimean War, Florence Nightingale had shown that large hospitals were not necessarily deadly. Good ventilation and cleanliness were the keys to success, and these qualities were mandatory in the new hospitals that were being built. General Hammond required that his medical officers submit regular reports of their cases, their treatments, and the results. These reports were compiled after the war by his successor into the 6 volumes entitled The Medical and Surgical History of the War of the Rebellion. This remarkable work was the first major American academic medical contribution recognized in Europe. His work provided detailed statistical documentation of medical and surgical management during the Civil War. Some extremely interesting case studies in there. There was one particular one. It was called Case A.L., age 57. Any idea who that might have been?
Abraham
Lincoln. It was his autopsy report. In the initial phases of the war, treatment of wounds was performed individualistically by the 2 or 3 doctors at the regimental field hospital. Now, gradually, in large part to the Sanitary Commission, who sent textbooks and monographs out to the physicians, and also as a result of the organization of the large divisional field hospitals, standards of treatment were developed. Now, to understand the nature of the problem facing these medical officers, it's appropriate that we take a brief look at the wounds that they faced. Pictures of the Civil War showing giant waves of troops storming enemy lines, such as this one. This is Union troops crossing what was became known as Burnside's Bridge at Antietam or Sharpsburg. Again, this implies much hand-to-hand fighting. This was far from the truth. In actuality, the majority of fighting took place over long distances. And this change came about due to the development of the rifled musket and the conodal bullet. The original non-rifled musket, or smoothbore, fired a round ball with an effective range of about 100 yards. And tactics using this smoothbore was called the medical officers that were commanding both armies were taught by. With the introduction of rifling and the conodal bullet or mini ball in 1847 that was developed by French Army Captain Claude Monet, it had an expanding base and the power of and accuracy of the rifle was increased dramatically. It now had an effective range of 300 to 500 yards. This advancement allowed defenders to fire at their attackers from long distances, inflicting devastating casualties to mass charges, as Grant found out at Cold Harbor. Scenes depicting hand-to-hand combat with bayonet or saber grossly overestimate the use of these weapons and are more Hollywood than fact. The volunteer soldier did not favor the cold steel of the bayonet, and the cavalrymen favored the pistol or the revolver over the saber. If we look at the statistics of the Civil War, 94% of all battlefield wounds were caused by bullets, 5.5% from artillery, and only 0.4% were inflicted by bayonet or saber. The lead bullets that were produced or were used produced far worse wounds than today's modern steel-jacketed bullets. They traveled at relatively slow speeds, and once they hit the human body, the bullets tended to flatten or mushroom out, carrying in particles of clothing, skin, dirt, etc., resulting in most wounds becoming infected. The round ball, whose use was limited to the early phases of the war, produced less trauma than the mini ball. The increased velocity and penetrating capacity of the mini was responsible for the devastating wounds that were seen during the war. Now, several years ago, Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, wrote a three-volume historical novel on the Civil War. And in one of the volumes, he had one of the best descriptions of what it was like to be hit by one of these rounds. And he has graciously given me his permission to include these few paragraphs in my presentation. 3,000 rounds of .58 caliber slashed across the open field. Muzzle velocity slow, but even at 700 to 800 feet per second, carried a frightful punch. The conodal round, weighing close to an ounce, made of soft lead. Sometimes the round sounded like the buzz of an angry bee or the hiss of a snake, and if it passed close enough to you, you'd feel the smack of the shockwave. If it hit human flesh, the sound was audible, like the open-handed slap. The slower speed at that instant, that microsecond the bullet struck, actually made the impact more deadly. The round would begin to flatten out, distort, as it first penetrated cloth, striking a button, a cartridge box sling, or a belt plate. Often it would begin to tumble, glancing off at a slight angle, mushrooming out as it tore into the body, and traveling so slow that it was not sterilized by the heat of its passage, dragging with it bits of black powder, towel that had been used to grease the ball, the fragments of whatever it had struck first before entering the body. Arteries that might have been cauterized by the passage of a high-speed jacketed round were instead torn open. The next pulse of the heart sending out a fresh spray of bright arterial blood. The truly frightful moment was when the round struck bone. It did not punch through the bone, rather it shattered. The shock of the blow causing the bone to disintegrate laterally, fissure lines and fractures running the length of the bone clear to the joint. Here the bullet would flatten out even more to the diameter of a quarter, at times to that of a half dollar, tearing everything in its path. If there was enough momentum left, the hunk of lead would exit the body, pulling out fragments of broken bone, marrow, flesh, and blood with it, sometimes striking the man behind the victim, injuring him as well, or spraying him with the contents of the comrade in front. If the ball struck between the ribcage and the pelvis, death was just a matter of time, be it seconds if a main artery was hit, or days of slow agony if it simply lodged in the intestine. A man shot crosswise might have his liver shattered, the stomach or small intestine punctured, the kidney torn apart. Within minutes, he would begin to bloat up as the blood cascaded into his abdominal cavity. To be shot through the lungs was almost as bad. It took time to die unless the bundle of arteries and veins linked directly to the heart was severed. The lungs would slowly fill up with blood and liquid, each breath a struggle to keep from drowning, sometimes air wheezing in and out of the bullet hole. If one was to be struck and die, the lucky shot was to the head or the heart. It would barely be felt if it was in the head, just a sudden blacking out of the light. If in the heart, more than one man would actually stop, look down, and have a few seconds to comprehend what had just happened. Perhaps even time to look up at a friend with that strange, quizzical look of men when they know they are dead but have yet to fall back into the earth. Since X-rays had not been discovered at the time of the Civil War, wound assessment was accomplished either by porcelain-tipped probes or, again, by the surgeon's most readily available probe, his finger. Many ingenious instruments were developed during the war for probing and extracting bullets, foreign bodies, and bone fragments. During the early phases of the war, there was great controversy as to whether anesthesia was appropriate or not. The New York Medical Journal argued against anesthesia on the grounds, quote, that the excitement of the wounded soldier was enough to carry him through the severest operation, and the shock following the injury was aggravated by anesthesia. It was believed that pain was an appropriate stimulus to prevent or modify shock, unquote. Obviously, the author of that article had never been wounded. Oh, they also thought anesthesia would regard wound healing. Despite this, anesthesia was used extensively at the beginning of the war and universally by the end. Ether was discovered either in 1842 or 1847, depending on who one believes is the discoverer of it, and chloroform was discovered in 1847 and was the agent of choice in field hospitals. As I mentioned before, the more humane surgeons would apply anesthesia even for wound examination. Now, chloroform was the preferred anesthetic because it had the advantages of having smaller bulk, it was non-flammable, it acted quicker to produce insensibility, and had a faster recovery time. Now, how many of you have had surgery and have been anesthetized? Okay. Didn't feel anything, did you? Out completely, right? Okay. Today, when you're put under an anesthetic with all their fancy gizmo machines that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, you are brought to a stage 5 level of anesthesia, which basically means the doctors have got to breathe for you. So you've got a tube down your throat. You've been intubated. Back during the Civil War, they were only brought to a stage 3. They were insensible to pain. Okay? So reports that you read of soldiers and officers walking by the surgeon's tent and hearing the soldiers moaning and groaning or maybe moving were quite accurate. But that was because they were in stage 3. But despite the moving, despite the moaning and groaning, they weren't feeling the pain of the operation. They were insensible to pain. Now again, today they have this big fancy machine to administer anesthesia. Back then, it was done by the drop method, which as you can see on this slide, you see the by the way, this is a staged picture. You notice that there is a rag over the patient's face. And what they would do is they would put a rag or they would take a marine sponge, hold it over there, and literally drop the ether or the chloroform onto that rag or that sponge and slowly lower it down to the patient until they became insensible. Amazingly, out of 80,000 general anesthetics given during the war, the death rate directly attributed to anesthesia was less than 4%. One of the major reasons that medical advances and thus the medical professionals of the Civil War are belittled or not appreciated was due to the fact that antisepsis and asepsis had still not been accepted or recognized. Antiseptic agents had been recognized many years prior to the start of the war, but they were used to spray the air, to get rid of the bad odors. Lister did not publish his first article on antisepsis until 1867. And American medicine didn't accept it for probably another 5 to 10 years. It has been said that if the Civil War occurred 10 years later, 1871 to 1875, many, many thousands of wounded would have survived, because antiseptics would have been available, or that were available, were used to clean the environment rather than the surgical instruments, bandages, or the wounds themselves. Sterilization or cleanliness of instruments had not yet been established. When surgeons did wash their hands or instruments, it was more to keep those instruments from slipping from the grasp. At times, water was so scarce that the surgeon may go days without even washing their hands. At the operating table, a surgeon may strop his amputating knife on the sole of his leather boot. Incidents have been recorded where the surgeon was holding his knife between his teeth while waiting for one patient to be removed and the other patient to be placed on the table. He operated barehanded in his regular clothes with his sleeves rolled up. The more efficient surgeons did hundreds of amputation in the space of 3 or 4 days, each amputation taking less than 5 minutes. Extremities were the most common location for wounds, and amputation of the limbs was the most common major operation during the war. At the start of the war, there was great conflict over amputation versus non-amputation. This was because of Dr. Guthrie. Now, Dr. Guthrie was the British Surgeon General during the Crimean War. He recommended against amputation because of the extremely high mortality rate that the British soldiers had suffered. And this was widely reported. What they didn't take into consideration was the horrendous, unsanitary conditions that were prevailing during the Crimea. Disease was rampant, sanitary conditions were non-existent. As a result, these soldiers died more from the infection than from the amputation. In December of 1861, Dr. D.D. Slade distributed a pamphlet from Boston containing more orthodox views regarding amputation, and his views were generally accepted. His indications for amputation were when a limb was badly lacerated or when there was a compound fracture, especially a fracture that was splinted or involved a joint. Amputations were considered necessary in almost 50% of all gunshot fractures of the limbs and covered a 26% mortality rate. Although amputation was widely criticized and many consider its use excessive, studies have suggested that it was not used widely enough. Penetrating abdominal wounds were universally fatal, as were wounds to the chest and the head. It was also discovered by the medical department that it was highly desirable to have railroad cars and ships equipped specifically for the transportation of the wounded. Early in the war, the wounded were evacuated by train, laying on straw and box cars, or in passenger cars if they could manage to sit up. These same box cars had just transported a cargo of horses, mules, or cattle, and were rarely, if ever, cleaned out before the wounded were placed in them. Gradually, with the help of such organizations as the U.S. Sanitary Commission and other groups, more and more hospital cars of varying design and offering greater comfort began to appear. In time, these cars were combined into hospital trains that might include cars used specifically for cooking, for dining, storage, or sleeping quarters for the medical staff. These trains were clearly identified by their bright red smokestack, engine, and tender, and by its three red lanterns at night. there has been no recorded instance of such a hospital train being molested by the enemy. Various sanitary commissions also helped outfit specially equipped hospital ships and provided these vessels of their own when necessary. The improvements in the management of hospitalization and evacuation achieved during the course of the Civil War are considerable. By the end of the war, evacuation tended to be as prompt and as systematic as the military situation permitted. As a result, the number of regimental medical officers in attendance drawn away from the field, from the battlefield, was minimal, and the need for tents and equipment for field or depot hospitals was limited. Although many patients still had to endure the rough ride from the battlefield in the army wagons, these were for short distances, and increasing numbers made the major portion of their journey north or east in the comfort of well-appointed hospital ships or trains. The hospitals they stayed at along the way were likely to be efficiently organized, and a better chance that they were hospitals they reached at the end of the journey were carefully designed and ventilated institutions where the staff was able to work efficiently. Now, you notice I haven't really touched about disease in this presentation. In the 19th century, disease exacted a heavy toll on large groups of men who were gathered closely together under conditions of stress and poor sanitation. Chickenpox, measles were deadly back then. Now, the volunteers from the cities had usually contracted these diseases and had immunity to them. But the vast majority of the soldiers were from the rural areas, had never been exposed to these diseases. As a result, if they caught chickenpox or measles, in a lot of cases, it was a death notice to them. In the Civil War, disease killed twice as many men as the battle. But the conflict thus provided millions of cases of various diseases for study. But the Union surgeons, like their counterparts everywhere, were still unable to distinguish harmless organisms from those causing disease. The developments that would make this possible were yet to come. Except for offering supportive care during the Civil War to help those stricken with diseases other than malaria, except for improved sanitation, they could do little to prevent disease other than smallpox. But their renewed appreciation for sanitation undoubtedly contributed to the marked drop in the disease rate in the post-war army as compared to the pre-war force. Despite voluminous records, medical officers made no significant progress during the Civil War towards finding ways in which to prevent or cure the diseases that ravaged the Union Army. The contributions to medical care that developed during the Civil War have not been fully appreciated, again, in all probability, because the quality of care administered is compared against modern standards rather than the standards of the time. Some of the specific accomplishments that constituted the major advances are as follows. The use of the lancet, and therefore bleeding, was virtually abandoned. Mobile military hospitals reached a degree of development hitherto unknown. Accumulation of adequate records and detailed reports for the first time permitted a complete military medical history. This led to the publication of the Medical and Surgical Journal of the History of the War of the Rebellion, and it was, which was identified in Europe as the first major academic accomplishment by United States medicine. The development of a system of handling mass casualties, including aid stations, field hospitals, and general hospitals, set the pattern for the management of the wounded through the Vietnam War. The development of the first organized ambulance corps, the first use of railroads and ships for transportation of the sick and wounded. The telegraph was used to send messages back and forth between the field medical directors and the rear area hospitals. The pavilion-style general hospitals, such as Chimborazo in Richmond, shown here, and Shatterley in Philadelphia, were well ventilated and clean, and were copied in the design of large civilian hospitals over the next 75 years, including the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. The importance of immediate definitive treatment of wounds and fractures was demonstrated, and it was shown that major operative procedures, such as amputations, were optimally carried out in the first 24 hours after wounding. The importance of sanitation and hygiene in preventing infection, disease, and death among the troops in the field was demonstrated. Separate hospitals for smallpox, venereal disease, eye problems, nervous disorders, gangrene, and others were established, setting a needed precedent. Female nurses were introduced to hospital care, and the first nurse corps was developed. The Catholic orders entered the hospital business. The Sanitary Commission was formed, a civilian organized soldiers' aid society that set the pattern for the development of the American Red Cross. Sanitary fairs for raising money for the relief of the sick and wounded were established. The experience and training of thousands of physicians were upgraded, and they were introduced to new ideas and standards of care. These included familiarity with prevention and treatment of infectious disease, with anesthetic agents, and with surgical principles that rapidly advanced the overall quality of American medical practice. The development of the Army Medical Museum, now the National Museum of Health and Medicine, of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and the Army Medical School. The staining of histopathological slides and photomicrography were introduced, and Hodgkin splint for femur fractures. But let us not forget the Confederate medical advances. Bean's dental fixation device, Smith's anterior leg splint, the sealing of sucking chest wounds, the use of indigenous plants, the use of plasterboard splints for mandible fractures, and the Confederacy was the first army to make dentistry a separate field within its military. We must not forget that the medical professionals of the Civil War era were some of the best trained doctors of their time, giving the standards of care and knowledge that existed during the most turbulent time in American history. Any questions? Yes, sir.
There was on C-SPAN recently, last weekend, they mentioned pension records and soldiers' personal records, that they said vaccination was used. This was U.S. colored troops. So the fact that maybe they were, the vaccination went bad, and maybe the colored troops may have been guinea pigs. This sounds like the usual story, but this is from letters and pension records. Have you come across vaccinations and studies of colored troops, their physiology and that?
Okay. Vaccination was available for smallpox, and they did use it. It wasn't the most sanitary method of doing it, and a lot of times when soldiers would do it, they would do it themselves rather than having the doctor do it for them. So as a result, most unsanitary method of doing it. Now, the belief had been that with the African Americans, that they had a higher immunity to some of the various diseases, such as malaria and smallpox. Okay, this was the thinking, that they were physiologically different from the white population. They got just as sick as the white folks did. They didn't have any special immunities. Maybe they tolerated the heat better, but other than that, they didn't do it. So again, I don't think that they used the black troops as guinea pigs for any experiments, because they were vaccinating and inoculating the white troops as well. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Were deaths from disease the same in wars prior to the Civil War?
No, they were higher. Again, fortunately, some things did advance, but yeah, disease from death was higher in the wars prior to the Civil War. Sir?
Even the Crimean War, that you mentioned earlier?
Of course, we didn't have any, you know, troops there. But yeah, it was pretty high during the Crimean War. Yes, sir.
How did they start to make the connection between disease and unsanitary conditions? What observations or
The question was, how did they make the decision or connection between disease and unsanitary conditions? Okay. First of all, again, like I said, antisepsis and asepsis was still several years away. Okay, they knew about infection. Okay, they knew about pus, but they thought pus was good. If it was the white, creamy, non-smelling pus, they thought that was a sign of healing. Now, they recognized that the yellow, greenish, foul-smelling pus was bad. It was a sign of infection. So they knew about infection. They knew about diseases. They just didn't know what caused them. They didn't know the mosquito caused malaria, things like that. Okay? Now, connection between unsanitary conditions and disease was very simple. When they started cleaning things up, they noticed the disease rates dropped. When they stopped putting a camp right next to a swamp or a marsh that was infested with mosquitoes, the disease rate went down. When they built hospitals that were well ventilated, that there was space between the patients, where the patients were bathed on a regular basis, okay, the disease rate went down. Again, they still didn't know the causes of these diseases. That was still several years ahead. But they noticed if they did X, then Y happened. If they didn't do X, Y didn't happen. Okay? Perfect example. Because of the blockade, as you can imagine, supplies into the South became harder and harder to come by, especially medical supplies, among them suture material. Okay? Well, the Confederate doctors, you know, there was a lot of horses around during the war. You know, they may have had their own horse to ride. Certainly their general officers had horses. The cavalry, the artillery, the wagons, all pulled by horses or mules. And they're saying, yeah, horses' tail's pretty long. Wonder if we could use it as suture material. So they tried it, but what they found out was that the tail was kind of stiff. So they would boil it, and it would soften it up. And they would suture their patients using this boiled horsehair. And lo and behold, the wounds didn't get infected. And they couldn't figure this out. All they knew is that if we boiled this horsehair and sutured the patients, the wounds didn't become infected. They had the same problem with bandages. They were running out of materials. So they would wash them and boil them and reuse them, and again, they noticed the wounds didn't become infected. So what were they doing by boiling this hair and these bandage materials? They were sterilizing them. Again, they didn't know why the wounds weren't getting infected. They just knew that when they boiled this stuff and used it, they didn't become infected. But if they didn't boil it and sterilize it, the wounds became infected. So again, it was more of a cause and effect. We try this, and this happens. We try that, doesn't happen. So it was a cause and effect type of thing. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah, specifically about the horsehair and the
Okay. That sounds... You had a question, sir?
Yes. One of the causes of death in the Civil War was death from the frying pan.
Yeah.
You know, considering the diet of most of the soldiers back then, a lot of grease, a lot of fat. And was the connection made early between, let's say, gastrointestinal disease and poor diet? And, or how long did it take until the connection was finally reached?
Yes, death by frying pan, I like that. It's funny, I was just reading an article in one of the Civil War magazines on Army rations. There was actually a captain of substance published a book in 1862 basically telling the soldiers how to cook their food because most of them had never cooked for themselves. They had their wives or their mothers that took care of them. Okay? So they didn't have to worry about it. So now here they are, and you know, God knows the food they got wasn't the best. You know, salt pork, hardtack, which was a 3-inch, you know, square of whatever it was made out of, God only knows, flour or whatnot that you could probably pound nails with. It was that hard. Or was infested with worms. Which is one reason that they would eat that stuff a lot of times at night. Just figure it was more protein that they were getting. But yes, you're right. An awful lot of fried food because all they had was salted pork, salted beef, things soldiers hated were desiccated vegetables, which was an attempt at dehydration of the vegetables. And they had all kinds of names for those vegetables, which I can't say in mixed company. But yeah, a lot of the problems they ended up with because of the diet was, you know, Tennessee trots, the Virginia two-step, you know, bad cases of dysentery, diarrhea, things like that. As time, you know, got around and they started teaching the soldiers how to cook this stuff. And in some cases, you might have found somebody within a group, within a company, that was very good at cooking. And that person would become the company cook, and he would do, you know, all the cooking. In other instances, sometimes the wives or even the mothers would follow their husbands or their sons, you know, on the march, and they would do the cooking, you know, for their husband, their son, and his, you know, however many comrades were in his mess at that time. But again, they finally, you know, over a period of time, they started putting two and two together, and you know, were realizing that the way they were cooking the food, the way they were eating it, or not preparing it. Was leading to these. So once they finally started issuing bulletins, for lack of a term, or cookbooks, then things got a little bit better. But again, you still, even with that, you know, you're on the march. You may not have the opportunity to, you know, actually sit down and cook a meal. So, you know, you might be grabbing green apples off of the tree. You know what happens when you eat too many green apples. You know, of course, the Confederacy, as the war went on and the Union troops got further and further south and destroying crops and you know, livestock and things like that, their food situation, which wasn't great to begin with, just gradually got worse and worse and worse.
Did the Confederate Army treat Union soldiers and vice versa, or are you pretty much on the own of your own army?
No, they. It was generally considered once a soldier was wounded, they were no longer the enemy. So you would have Confederate soldiers or Confederate doctors treating Union doctors treating Confederates, and sometimes after the major battles, Gettysburg in particular, 32 Confederate surgeons stayed back with the wounded that were too bad off to transport, and they were working side by side in the field hospitals with the Union surgeons until the last of them left, and then they were given a parole and sent back to their lines. Medical personnel, thanks to Stonewall Jackson's medical director, Hunter Holmes McGuire, were considered non-combatants, which meant that if you volunteered to stay behind with your sick and wounded, if your army was driven off the field, once you treated all your wounded, then you can go back across the lines and rejoin your army. Now, this stopped when Grant took over in 64. Grant stopped the exchange of prisoners, mainly because, and did away with the non-combatant status of medical personnel. Because he realized North had a population of 21 million, and the South had a population of 9 million. Half of that 9 million were African Americans. So, you know, 21 million versus 9 million, hey, we can afford, as cruel as it might sound, we can afford to have our soldiers in prisoner of war camps. We can afford not to let, to exchange the medical officers. The South can't afford it. So that's where that went. Yes, ma'am.
Was there a treatment for diarrhea?
Gentleman says Swiss cheese. It was a blue mass, which was basically an opium derivative. So they give you that and hope for the best. Ma'am.
What kind of care or lack of it was there in the prisoner of war camps like Andersonville?
Andersonville is I can't say a unique situation. North had POW camps worse than Andersonville. Elmira up in New York, Camp Douglas over in Chicago. By the time Anderson came into existence, the South was really hurting. They didn't have enough food or medical supplies for their own people, let alone the prisoners of war. The doctors that went to Andersonville did the best they could with what they had, which was virtually nothing. So, you know, even though the North was better supplied and everything, from reports I read, they didn't treat the Confederate POWs any better than the Confederates treated those down in Andersonville. Ma'am.
How prevalent were diseases that were rampant at that time, such as diphtheria, typhoid, and consumption? How prevalent were these in the...
They were, you know, fairly prevalent. Consumption, for those of you who don't know, is what we call tuberculosis today. Pretty much no treatment for that. Typhoid and diphtheria was more preventative than anything else, which was mainly getting the heck out of the area, you know, where the disease was prevalent. Which was, you know, a lot of times, you know, if you ever read any historical novels, particularly in the South, Charleston, New Orleans, those that could afford to would move inland during the sickly time. That's when the typhoid, the yellow fever, the malaria became prevalent. So they would go up in country, away from the swamps and the marshes and stuff like that. So, they were getting a handle on it, but it was still pretty prevalent. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I haven't heard that there was much about tetanus. It must have been around, but I haven't read or heard a lot about that.
To be honest with you, neither have I, but I agree with you. It was probably around. I mean, you know, between stepping on rusty nails and, you know, things like that, and other things that cause, you know, tetanus and lockjaw and things like that. But yeah, you're right. I haven't read a whole heck of a lot about it. Not sure whether they didn't recognize it, or it got lumped into, you know, other things. There's a lot of diseases that were lumped into the different types of the intermittent fevers and stuff like that. Not that tetanus is a fever, but it's possible it might have gotten lumped into another another category not reported as tetanus. Any other questions? Sir?
Tetanus related to horses somehow? Are horses that have a lot of tetanus? I've heard that you step on a rusty nail near a place with a lot of horses. I don't know.
I can't answer that. I like horses, but I stay away from them. They're bigger than me. I've got two horses that live in my house. They're called Great Danes. About like that. That's as close to a horse as I want to get. So I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer. Any other questions? Okay. Just a couple of things before we end this tonight. If you have never been to a reenactment, I strongly encourage you. I know with what Rachel's working on with the 150th celebrations here in Ohio, there's going to be a number of them going on throughout the state. And if I can be so bold as to plug a few of mine, the last weekend of June down in Reynoldsburg, which I know it's a 3-hour drive, but anyway, at Civic Park in Reynoldsburg, we're having a reenactment. Obviously, we'll have both Union and Confederate. There'll be President Lincoln, General Lee, General Grant. If we can ever find Jeff Davis, we'll get him there. We'll have artillery demonstrations. We have things for the ladies to do, kids to do. We will have several simulated leg amputations. We are looking for volunteers. We accept Blue Cross and Gray Shield. Medicinal is free, and there's no copay. But and again, I'm sure if you check Rachel's website there, you'll find out several others. I know there's some that are normally occur up in this part of the state, but if you've never been to one, I highly encourage you to go through the camps, talk with the reenactors, find out what life was like for the soldiers back during the Civil War. Again, thank you very much for coming out, and have a safe trip home.